Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I'm supposed to say something here. Let's see. What is it?
You talk, because my ears are not working at all.
Your ears are not working? That's a bad thing. Okay. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only a radio program, which you may have concluded if you're listening on the radio, or an internet program if you're listening on the internet. It is also the name of registered investment advisory firm that does wealth management out of Salado, Texas, and is regulated by the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. And why do we say that? Because we're kind of proud of it. You have to have $100 million or more under management to get regulated by the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. Otherwise, you're regulated by the state. So we go, nah, 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 we got a bunch of money to manage.
That's not generally how we say it.
It isn't the way we say it? We don't say it that way?
No.
Anyway, the stuff we talk about on here, stuff being a technical term, is stuff we have gotten,
is information we have gotten
from sources we believe to be reliable and we earnestly think are reliable, but we don't make no warranty or guarantee that it is truth, justice, and the American way. Let's see, what else? This is not investment advice when we talk on air, despite the fact that Jake and Jeff, that's who Jeff's talking, are the principals and advising members of the Personal Wealth Coach, the investment advisory firm. What we have here is educational information, or informational education as the case may be, and the opinions and stuff we talk about on here have nothing to do with Town Square Media except for the fact they're providing the electricity and they get us to come on here and play commercials, and we don't have anything to do with commercials, and they don't have anything to do with the stuff we talk about.
That's pretty good. Close cover before striking. Unauthorized personnel only be on this point.
That's right. I like that. Anyway, so we had a week in the market this week, although you couldn't have told it if you went to sleep at the beginning of the week and you woke up at the end of the week and you looked at the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, you would conclude that not much happened. I mean, it started out just barely above, right at 2,800. And it ended at 2801.83. It was up 0.2% for the week. It weaved up and down during the week, as we say in the newsletter this week. It was caught on the horns of a dilemma. On one side, we have record corporate earnings coming in for the second quarter, and they do look good. Johnson & Johnson and mostly the domestic companies who do business domestically in things that didn't get tariffed yet are doing very, very well. And despite the fact that Caterpillar, John Deere, and companies of that ilk did really well on their earnings, their stocks are down because the market is anticipating, or the people who invest in the market are anticipating, that the tariffs are really going to hurt them because their CEO said so. I mean, basically, if you were at Caterpillar and you make a lot of things out of steel and all of a sudden there's a shortage of steel and the steel you can get is 50% more expensive than it used to be, I think your prices are going to go up. And if that happens and the dollar goes up, which it has, then it's going to be kind of hard to export a lot of heavy construction equipment around the world, despite the fact that they are were and maybe still are for the moment, the leading purveyor of major heavy construction equipment around the world. They're kind of hurting right now. At least they anticipate hurting. They're doing really well for the present. So you got this conflict in the market.
Multiple conflicts.
And there's several going on, but just two big ones. One is we got record earnings. Everything looks really hums. Unemployment is so low that the claims for new jobless benefits last month came in at the lowest level since 1969. I wanted to say 96, but I'm a little dyslexic. 1969. And in 1969, the workforce was a tiny little sliver of what it is today. So that's pretty darned impressive. and industrial production was up 0.8%. You start down the list of all the good news in the economy, and the record earnings that are going on, and if you just looked at that far, you'd say, whoa, the stock market should be zooming upward by double digits, and in fact, it's not going anywhere. The reason? The stock market works on things that are anticipated in the future, and in the future, there's kind of a consensus that tariffs and higher interest rates and labor shortages and trucking shortages are going to cause this economy to hit a wall at some point. And so there's some caution on the part of investors. And we'll see what happens. Things don't always work out the way Mr. Market thinks they're going to work out. The yield curve continues to flatten. That may not mean anything to you, but
it just means that interest rates are getting closer and closer together for short-term loans to long-term loans. Mm-hmm. And that's generally not a good thing. It means people are going to be less likely to make long-term loans.
Yeah, the issue is that when the yield curve starts to flatten, it means there's less demand for long-term loans and more demand for short-term loans. And that means that businesses and so on are looking at it in the future and saying, maybe we got a problem.
There's a couple of reasons for this. Who's borrowing? That's the big question. So
the government.
Yes, the government. Because what we've just said.
Can I just say that correctly? The government.
The government.
Government.
What we just said is that we've got record earnings. Across the stock market, that's kind of the case. It's not every company, obviously, but the vast majority of companies are coming in above expectations. We're hitting record numbers for earnings for the S&P 500. That's not generally the picture of a group of entities that are wanting to go out and borrow a lot of money. When you have record earnings, you have extra cash. So they're not going out and releasing tons of bonds into the market. That's how they borrow money. Who is? Well, the government is. And the government is sticking very, very closely to a rule book that is not necessarily a long-term smart rule book, but it's something that allows for some more flexibility in certain circumstances, and that is that they're borrowing short-term. They're borrowing the money that they're borrowing, the majority of it they're borrowing at 3 years or less. Which means that if there's a lot of demand to borrow, so let's kind of go back and give a good example of this. Say you are in elementary school in the lunch line. Can you put yourself there for a moment? You're in the lunch line at elementary school. You got this?
I'm thinking about it.
We're going to have to change your age, otherwise people are going to look at you
funny. I'm feeling a little awkward being my age.
Yeah, so we're going to make you 8 years old. You're in the lunch line. You have in your pocket $5.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money for an 8-year-old. But lunch costs $1, which is maybe not inflation adjusted.
Used to cost 35 cents.
Right, well, that's not inflation adjusted either.
I remember when it cost 35 cents.
When I was in school, it cost 90 cents, and that was subsidized, obviously. But so we're using some round numbers,
smell it.
So you've got $5. Your friend in front of you says, hey, can I borrow $1 for lunch? I'll pay you back tomorrow. I will gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today, they say.
Okay.
And you say, sure, and you give them $1, and the friend behind you says, me too. Well, you're a little bit more reluctant to share that second dollar. So in a business setting, you would charge more for that because you're giving up more money than you expected to. There's a higher demand. All right. So then third friend and fourth friend and fifth friend are all demanding.
No. We don't go to five because I'm not going to have $1 for my lunch.
Right. That is your reserves. If you're a bank, you're required to keep your reserves because somebody might want the money or you might need to eat. So you're going to charge.
I'm in the lunch line.
You're going to charge more for that. So it's a supply demand issue. Interest rates go up when there's a higher demand for something. If all of the kids in the lunch line are asking to borrow money, that money becomes more and more expensive. If nobody wants to borrow your money, like that first friend is the first one that comes up and says, hey, can I borrow $1? It's no big deal. You give them $1, you're not going to charge them very much for it. That's what we're seeing in the yield curve. There's a lot of demand for short-term money and not a lot of demand for long-term money. which means that the interest rates are going up short term and the long term interest rates are going down, which means banks are less likely to look for business in that long term area. And we have a caller on 773. We did have a caller. We don't have a caller anymore.
Gave up on us.
I've given up on us multiple times. Anyway, that's the explanation of the flattening yield curve. If you just plot out short term at an interest rate and long term at an interest rate, the long term interest rate, if all other things are rational and normal, that long term interest rate is going to be a higher interest.
Looks like we have another caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. About maybe 2 or 3 days, I had a letter come in from the mail giving my money back. It was a $300 check. And how this started, I'm a veteran, and they couldn't do the procedure at the VA, so therefore I went to Scott & White, and it was like TRICARE insurance out of the VA, and they charged me $300 out of pocket before I had the procedure done, and this was about 6 months ago. And then I received this letter with a check for $300, and it kind of surprised me because I wasn't thinking I was going to be getting this money back. Do y'all know any kind of way that they do this? Am I going to be owing it back again, or are they just refunding me back my money? Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
We don't know anything about the specifics of your case, obviously, but this is the type of thing that happens when if you went to Scott & White and they made an error on your TRICARE insurance, and the TRICARE insurance, in fact, paid for a procedure that you paid $300 for, they are required to refund the money, and apparently they have. So, and knowing Scott & White as well as I do, being a person who's been in and out of that big house a few times, they don't refund money until they're absolutely sure they have need to refund it. They're a little reluctant. That's why it took them several months to do it.
Probably. It sounds like the money came from TRICARE, though, but it's hard to tell. He didn't really say.
Well, TRICARE paid for the procedure, and they had charged him for the procedure. They're required by law to refund the money to him.
The other side of it, and this is, again, we don't know what's happening in your specific, but if we'll just take out Scott & White, take out TRICARE, and just say insurance company hospital. If the hospital charges you money and the insurance company should have been the one to pay that money, they've got to reimburse you. Their time limit on it is extremely long. I wouldn't be too worried about having to pay it back just because the paperwork to figure out what's going on their end is going to be pretty hard. They're not very good at figuring this out. Otherwise, they would have sent you the money shorter than 6 months ago. The whole concept of what's going on with the insurance companies and the medical cost, not knowing what's going on, the separation of the patient who's the customer from the cost is one of the major hurdles that we're going to have to take care of in the next 5 or 6 years. We've got to figure this out. We've had a big stall in figuring it out because of a political divide. When Obamacare was passed and no Republicans voted for it, and I've said this about any bill where it's only one party passing it, just expect that bill to come back in contention whenever the next party's in charge. It's just the way this is the way human nature works. You did this without my permission, so when it's my turn, I'm going to take it away. Obamacare was not a good solution. It was an okay solution, and I know people hear me say, okay, wait a minute. I'm not saying it's the fruit of Satan. No, it's a okay solution. It wasn't the best possible solution. I don't know that that's possible. What does that mean, best possible that isn't possible? It wasn't the best solution by any stretch. I don't even know that it was a good solution, but it was at least applying some long-term bipartisan opinions to something, and the fact that it wasn't bipartisan when it passed is a completely different thing. There were a lot of that was very, very partisan stuff in there too. But that's kicked the can down the road because Democrats can't say, they can't open their mouth and say there's something wrong with Obamacare. And Republicans can't open their mouth and say there's something right with Obamacare because the way it was passed originally was so divisive. So we've put a big stall on fixing this situation at the federal level, and the states are kind of stepping back away from it, saying, I'm not going to touch this because the federal government might come in and take the cookies that we put in the pile instead of using them appropriately.
All right, then we got that one beat.
Yep, got that one beat. Let's see what's going on here. We've got some good stuff. This is a demographic piece. If you don't mind, I can jump in just for a moment.
All right.
Is a the demographics of our nation are fascinating to me. It's a big component of economics. If you talk about GDP, gross domestic product, that's whether or not the nation as a whole is profitable, if we're growing economically. And anybody that's listened to us for very long or been around economics at all, that's really broken into two pieces. Demographics, do we have a growing population? Is it educated? And productivity. Again, that's education and ability to do things. It's work ethic. It's a lot of things. Our productivity has been growing. Our demographics have not. We've come to a stall. 2016 is a dip, is a record for the country as far as per capita birth rate. It's the lowest we have ever seen since the founding of the country. People aren't having a lot of kids. So demographics is fascinating. What I'm bringing this up for is because it sounds like this won't have anything to do with economics. We're seeing a shift in demographics. I'm going to read two headlines. One headline, Wall Street Journal, America's factory towns, once solidly blue, are now a GOP haven. That's one headline. Second headline, Democrats could become a free trade counterweight to Trump. We're seeing a shift in demographics. We're seeing the Republicans and the Democrats kind of doing a square dance where they're switching positions on a whole series of areas. When it comes to free trade, when it comes to who's for the worker, who's for the business owner, there's a lot of shifts taking place right now, and they're doing it rather subtly, but there's a lot of them happening. So what we're seeing is something that we get to see about once every generation and a half, and that is the parties switching positions. In the 1960s, Jim Crow, the party that was representing equal rights was the Republicans.
Wait, you said in the 1960s, Jim Crow, the party that was...
Yeah, in the Jim Crow era.
Okay.
The party that was representing equal rights and stop segregation was the Republican side. And the Democrats were the draw the line and say no, and the Democrats held the South. We saw that shift over the following couple of decades, and Reagan was a big force in that. He took the yellow dog Democrats and slowly made them more conservative. So we saw the South of the United States shift from Democrat to Republican. And it was not a sudden shift in the underlying belief structure of the South. I mean, there have been shifts, but the parties switched. The parties changed. The platform changed. And we're starting to see that again. The Republicans are being more like what the Democrats were a decade ago. And the Democrats are being more like what the Republicans were a decade ago. Now, there's some certain areas that haven't shifted at all. But I find it really fascinating that it's as likely today for a union member to vote Republican as to vote Democrat. 5 years ago, voting Republican as a union member would have been something that would have caused lack of sleep at night for the rest of the year for that person. So we're seeing this shift, and I find it fascinating. I'm just observing it happening. I think a lot of people have felt it. Every time the parties shift like this, the independents grow in number because everybody's confused. Wait a minute, what does the party stand for anymore? And I've heard a lot of that. What do Democrats stand for? We really don't know. What do Republicans stand for? I'm not really sure. Compared to what I think if somebody could say that, a lot of confusion would be cleared up.
Yeah, there may be. It's hard to tell, and this is one of those reshaping periods. But I think right now, the parties are no longer Republican and Democrat.
Not at the moment. You're right.
That's Trump and anti-Trump.
Yeah. And some would say it began during Obama, when it was Obama anti-Obama, that it's just picked up steam and now it's Trump anti-Trump. And that, I think both of those are correct. And that's the way it has to happen for platforms to shift. When the Democrats are saying free trade, they're not saying it because deep down they support free trade, although if they say it enough, they will. That's the thing about repeating a thing enough to yourself. They're free trade because Trump seems to be not free trade. So they're just going anti.
And it used to be we had conservatives and liberals. We really don't anymore.
No, it's a mixed bag.
Populists and everybody else. And the thing about everybody else is they're pretty divided. And populist is a little hard to define. It basically is gut reaction. And that's just where we are. We're not, but the interesting thing is in the United States, we're not the only nation that's like that.
No, it's happening across the world.
Both Austria and Italy have recently elected what are called populist governments. Basically, whatever the, what used to be called the mob, and I guess it still could be called the mob, wants.
Back when the mob wasn't such a negative term.
Right.
In Rome.
Basically, when the whatever the vox populi, that's where the term came from, which is the people, the mass of people want immediately, short term, is what a populist will support. And they then support the populist, and the populist then feeds back the information to them. Usually populists are people that used to be something else, like President Trump was not very long ago a registered Democrat. And he was pro-abortion and a whole series of things. And he figured out that if he took a select, very impassioned group within our society that felt like they'd been left out, and he supported their views, he could get elected president. It worked quite well for him. And we're in a transition, like Jake said, at this point. And it's a transition that occurs not very frequently.
And it has other reasons for happening. They're not political reasons. They're economic reasons often.
Basically, they typically go 50 or 60 years between these occurrences, and the people don't remember the previous positions. And at some point, it'll all settle out, and we'll go back to having ideological differences as opposed to reaction differences. But right now, what we got is what we got.
Yeah.
Back to the economy, if we could.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to tie that into the economy.
Okay, go ahead.
The economic push for this shift in political opinion is from an aging population. When you have a group of people that has been the majority for their entire life, but population has shifted, they're going to feel threatened, and that can be in any situation. It affects productivity, though. When people feel threatened, they're not as productive. They don't work as much. The unions began as an extremely, almost communist concept that became capitalist when the unions and the business owners figured out how to work properly with each other. Some places that became institutionalized. So in Germany, it's an institution. The unions are mandatory. The business owners meet with the unions, and they must mandatorily work together. There's a government system in place on how that's supposed to work. Here, we're much more free business. So it's each business decides how to work with a union or not work with a union. And the management at each business has to determine how to negotiate with the union. And each union has to negotiate with each business owner. And that's what we're used to. as the unions aged, they became less and less sensitive to the needs of the business. So when the union started, it was first about workers' rights. Well, we made a bunch of laws to fix workers' rights issues. They're not totally fixed. I mean, there's still violations that happen, people not getting paid and so on. That's what lawsuits are for. You come forward, and the unions that were all about making sure that the business was profitable, but that the people that were working for the business got paid well, stopped being so concerned about whether the business was profitable, and that caused the downturn. It caused a bankruptcy in, like, General Motors, this stalwart of the American world, went bankrupt because the unions forgot that you're not supposed to dissect the goose that lays the golden egg. If you do that, it stops laying golden eggs. General Motors died and had to be rebirthed as a Frankenstein for a while. And in the Frankenstein stage, the union contracts got thrown out, which causes the unions to immediately go, oh, we better be concerned about the profitability of the business again. Those shifts that take place are based in habit. And the shift that's happening now, a lot of people have felt unheard by what they considered for most of their lives the liberal side of the world. Unheard and downtrodden. Come forward, give this group of people a voice, and they don't want to give it up. And it does affect the productivity of a nation. The nation, right now, if you measure productivity for a Trump supporter versus a someone that would be a hardcore liberal, what you'll find is that productivity has gone up in the Trump supporters in the past year, while the liberals' productivity has dropped. So politics does affect the economy. It's just longer term, and watching the shift as people who have had a drop in productivity for the last decade are having a jump in productivity, while people whose productivity have been going up for a decade, to watch that slow down, it's just fascinating to me to watch it happen with the political parties too.
Okay.
That's how I was tying it into the economy.
Makes sense.
Now you had something you were going to say that was quite important.
Well, why don't we break for commercials, being we're about halfway through the hour.
Sounds good. Can
and
do.
And then we can come back on the other side. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. Any questions or thoughts or comments you have about the economy, about investing or investments, we're here to talk about it. We've been doing it a long time, and I've seen a lot come and go, and probably have an answer if you have a question. So give us a call.
It may not be the right answer, but we're going to try.
And it's 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side of these important words from Town Square Media sponsors. Once more into the breach, dear friends.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another segment part of the Personal Wealth Coach. And the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. And I was going to talk about stuff, so let's talk about stuff.
All right. Stuff sounds good.
In the midst of all the noise about Putin and President Trump and so on, a little tidbit came out in an interview. The president said he was ready with $500 billion
against China.
Additional tariffs against China. Now, let's talk about it. I want to talk about tariffs for just a second. And we talked about this in the newsletter, but it's certainly worth considering. There's an interesting, from an economist's point of view, there's some interesting and confirming things going on. Since the tariff war has, the trade war has kicked into high gear, I guess it's not in high gear yet, but since it's going really
it'll get in the high,
roll.
It will certainly be in high gear if we do 500, that's 100% of the imports from China.
Yeah. So if it gets into a full roll, it'll be a bigger thing. But right now, it's already gotten into enough of a roll that it has depressed, and the Chinese aren't doing this. As a matter of fact, the Chinese are trying to prop up the value of their currency pretty hard right now. But despite that, the yuan renminbi has dropped 7% in value against the dollar, and which, of course, makes Chinese goods less expensive in the United States and at least partially offsets the tariffs that are being imposed on Chinese goods. If this were to continue, the drop in the Chinese currency would pretty close to equal, if the president does what he said and basically puts a 10% tariff on everything from China. But if the Chinese currency drops another 3%, it will have no effect other than causing it will cause some disruptions, and it'll cause it, but it really has no effect because the drop in the currency offsets the tariff that's imposed. Now, here's the issue.
Can we discuss why the drop in the currency happens? What causes currencies to be worth less against other currencies?
Basically, people are selling the currency as opposed to buying the currency.
It's selling it for another currency.
Right. They're trading it off because they sense that the United States was and still is the biggest customer for Chinese goods, the biggest single customer, not... We don't have a majority of the exports from China, but we're their biggest single customer. And if your biggest single customer says, I'm mad at you, and if you were a stock company and your biggest single customer says, I'm mad at you, and I'm going to charge my customers extra to buy stuff from you, or my employees extra to buy stuff from you, or whatever, which is kind of the way we're putting it, it would cause the stock value of that company, the company that's making and selling the stuff, to go down. Well, in many ways, the currency of a nation, not in every way, but in many ways, the currency of a nation is effectively its stock value. And so the Chinese currency starts to fall in value. And it's just, as the other side of it is, you know in physics, every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
Right. There's a balance, an equilibrium.
Right. And the same is true in economics. Mess around with economics and cash flows is like pools of water. If you change one, you change another one if they're connected, and they are connected. And here's the fascinating thing about the price. If the yuan, renminbi, let's just call it the yuan, stays down, which it looks like it's going to because the Chinese are doing everything they can to prop it up and it's not going up, versus the dollar, what will happen is the Chinese ultimately will be selling more stuff to the rest of the world. For instance, steel in the United States is around, what, $900 a ton?
We're using hot-rolled steel as our measure.
It is $900-and-some-odd dollars a ton. And in the rest of the world, it's $600-and-some dollars a ton. And that is affected by the fact that Chinese are a pretty good-sized steel producer, and they don't export a lot of steel to the United States. But because we put a blanket tariff on steel, the price of steel has risen dramatically in the United States.
Yeah, we're at $913 a ton.
It's depending on exactly what steel you're trying to get. In anecdotal reports, somewhere between 40% and 50% rise in the cost of steel and items made from steel in the United States, whereas the price around the rest of the world dropped. And this has potentially some very long-term and potentially negative effects. It means that companies like we mentioned earlier, Caterpillar, are going to have a lot of trouble exporting. They're one of our bigger exporters. They're going to have a lot of trouble staying in first place as an exporter of construction equipment from the United States. In matter of fact, in order to stay in business because of these tariffs, Caterpillar probably will need to start locating its manufacturing facilities overseas. Why? Not because they're anti-American, not because of a lack of patriotism or anything else. The issue is, by the time you get a double tariff, a tariff for the import of the raw material and the making of the raw material, because steel in the United States, domestic producers raise their prices to match import prices, which means they tacked another 25% onto the cost of steel.
Let's say, just to give you the price number differential, July of last year, 1 year ago, the price of 1 ton of hot rolled steel on the spot market that's buying it for today, instead of a futures contract, was below $600 a ton. It is now up at 913. So
and it remains around
50% increase.
Right. It remains around 600 in the 600 something range around the rest of the world. So what happens is it causes the price of steel to be more expensive in the United States, which creates a degree of inflation. It hasn't filtered through much to the average person today. However, we have seen some of the filter come through in the earliest tariffs. The first tariffs to come out were on washing machines.
Yep. And washing machine prices went up by 25% when there was a 10% tariff. The sales of washing machines in the United States dropped 25% while prices went up 25%.
Yep. So what's happening is we're already feeling some economic pain in washing machines, which is not a big thing.
Phillips is in some trouble right now.
What is a big thing, and we got to wait till next month to see if this persists or if it's just a blip, is housing starts in the United States in June dropped 12.3%. Now, 1 month drop in housing starts of that magnitude, that's a big drop. Single family homes we're talking about. You take a look at that and you go out and say, well, we generally see weather or something major has changed. We don't know. We won't know until we see what happens with July's home sales. However, anecdotally, the home manufacturing corporations have said the issue is pretty simple. There is a big tariff on lumber coming out of Canada, and since we import a lot of lumber from Canada, U.S. lumber manufacturers raise their prices to match the higher price coming out of Canada because they want to make as much profit as they can. And lumber is a big piece of the cost of a $200,000, which is a pretty average home in the United States. $200,000 home has seen the price of lumber as a part of that house go up about $10,000 since the tariffs were imposed. That's a 5% increase. Now,
just as a side note, when you're putting money down on a house and you've got 20% to put down as a down payment for building a house, if you think about that number as that's a pretty big number for people to reach up to, 20%, it's important for banks to see that you have the commitment. A 5% increase on the total price is a significant out-of-pocket event for everybody involved.
And that's just from lumber.
Right.
The other thing that's...
Labor's not even part of this yet.
Labor obviously is up because we have a labor shortage, but there's another item in there, and I was unable to find any specific percentage information on this because I went looking for it this week. I did find nail manufacturers at the wholesale level across the United States. Now, nail distributors. There's the one nail manufacturer in the United States is about to shut its doors because of the tariffs, the price
when you say,
increase on
are
steel.
Are you saying nail or nail?
Nail.
You hammer.
Yes.
The
stuff that holds the lumber together. There was only one nail manufacturer left in the United States, and it says unless they can get an exclusion, and so far its exclusion has not been considered, it's going to have to shut its doors because they can't price.
They just did a big expansion last year, too. They expanded and bought a whole series of new machines to do taped nails. So that's
for nail guns.
They've had to completely abandon that whole part of the plant because the price of the steel went up, which meant that they've got to charge a lot more per nail. Mm-hmm. And there's not a tariff on nails coming from anywhere else in the world. And there's a tariff on steel.
So what's happening is, but the prices of nails have gone up across the board in the United States, and I've not found any statistical information, but there's a significant, believe it or not, there's a significant cost for steel and nails going into a house in the United States. And when you see price rises across the board, that also is pumping up the cost on houses. So what you've got is new home sales have to, in order, if you're going to go out and you're going to sell a house that for the square feet that's available and it's been in the area, you've got $200,000 houses are a certain size. When a company says, okay, in order to build another $200,000 house, I'm going to have to charge 5 to 10% more to build that house in many cases, they can't get the mortgage for that because it takes a while. First, you have to sell some houses at 10% above market price in order to generate a demand, in order to generate an indication, and they just right now they're stuck because the price. We don't have any significant inflation in the United States, and we don't have wages going up. But in order to maintain profitability, the home manufacturers need to raise the price of a new house between 5 and 10%. And that is probably, there's no certainty at this point, the cause of a 12.3% drop in new home construction. Now, that's significant. And it's significant because housing starts get followed very, very carefully because they are one of the leading economic indicators. And when I say leading, they're long-term leading economic indicators.
Now, we had a drop similar in scope to this in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And it was based on some other debt issues that were still being resolved from the prior recession. I mean, if you think back to the first-time home buyer credits and the ability to take money out of IRAs and so on, when that expired, it caused this level of drop in housing starts.
And
we didn't have anything expire to cause this level of drop. This is just the prices of goods and labor.
And we came very close to having a recession in 2015.
That's correct.
But we didn't have any of the other signs. We didn't have an inverted yield curve. There's another oddity out there. By the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. It's kind of weird. We talk about the fact that lumber prices are up and steel prices are up, and we can say, well, that could be natural supply and demand. It might not have anything to do with the tariffs, except for the fact that copper prices have dropped about 20% since
right.
the tariffs were imposed.
And if we look at what the price of steel was doing before the tariff, it was steadily dropping. That's part of the reason why the Trump administration and the president used as an example, because there was an extra supply of steel out there, and it was eventually going to put some steel manufacturers out of business in the United States. His reaction caused steel prices to go up here and get cheaper elsewhere. And that's an issue.
It also put us in an interesting position where we can't very well afford to export steel because our steel is more expensive than anyone else's steel.
Right. It may actually put the nail in the coffin, literally
yeah.
the nail in the coffin for a lot of steel manufacturers in the United States.
Well, not a lot of manufacturers who use steel.
Right. Well, I mean pure steel. I mean mm-hmm. people that are making hot rolled steel in the United States are getting a bigger business from the United States, but a big chunk of that was also being sent to other countries. And it's not happening anymore because the prices are higher here because we have a higher demand. You can't turn around and sell to another country at the going rate when your steel is worth more here.
The other thing is if you follow the dollar, and we do, versus other currencies, the issue is that the dollar is up significantly over the last year. And that makes U.S. goods more expensive to sell overseas. The president mentioned this week that he didn't like the fact that the dollar was so high. Well,
it's what happens when you institute tariffs. There's
again,
really not been a point in history that a strong country instituting tariffs didn't have their currency go up.
Right. So the bottom line to it is, there's a lot of things going on secondarily out there that are likely to affect the economy in the long term that are a direct result of the tariffs. And it's one of those things I think an educated populace is really, really important. It's important to understand, for instance, Orrin Hatch, senator, in one of the greatest supporters of President Trump through the entire thing, has expressed some very severe reservations about the tariffs and about the trade war. The reason is if a bunch of nations get together, most nations, let's just say, and they impose tariffs or economic sanctions or whatever against a given country, which happened with Iran.
Orrin Hatch, just as a side note, is also the Finance Committee chairman
right.
for the Senate.
And then it has a negative, a strong negative impact on the country that's targeted. On the other hand, if a single country, as in this case the United States, imposes tariffs on everybody else, it has the same effect, except that it has effect long-term on the country that imposes the tariffs.
Right. It's kind of like the rest of the world imposing a steel tariff on us. They say your steel is going to be more expensive than everybody else's, only we did it to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And then the counter tariffs throw in on top of it. So this is one of those things where, very frankly, a big event has occurred here this year, and it's kind of a big economic experiment. We had a massive tax cut, which historically and projectedly in every other way, is going to cause the United States to next year borrow $1 trillion. The deficit this year will be around $800 billion. Next year should be around $1 trillion, according to the Treasury.
The Treasury just came out and said that it's probably going to be closer to $900 billion. $890 billion is what they're projecting
for
currently.
Next year?
For this year.
Or for this year's
based on revenues coming in.
Well, then it'll go up to about $1 trillion next year. And that causes, and we, as Jake was explaining in the lunch line scenario a few minutes ago, because of the fact that we want to borrow a lot of money, we're going to have to pay more interest rates for it, which causes interest rates to rise in the short term since we're borrowing short term. And this is what's really weird. Short-term interest rates means that if you're in Germany or Japan or someplace and you want to get a higher interest rate on a completely safe government bond, you turn to the United States and you send money to the United States and you buy a U.S. Treasury bond or U.S. Treasury note or bill because we've got the higher interest rates. Why do we have the higher interest rates? Because we're borrowing a lot of money, which messes with our trade deficit. Then you turn around and impose tariffs. It's a very complicated thing. Very rarely, and I mean, in my 35 years of watching this, this is the first time I have seen a consensus of economists that are saying we are very likely to have a recession 2 years from now. Generally speaking, they can't agree about when a recession, and they can talk about probabilities, and they're not sure when it's going to happen because there's such a big dynamic in the economy. And this is a test of economic science, because basically the fiscal policy, that's the government policy concerning taxes and wealth, is very likely to goose the economy this year and into next into very, very high GDP growth. That same policy, according to the science of economics, will probably generate a hangover of rather significant proportions in 2020. And this will be an interesting thing to watch from an economics point of view. And we're kind of getting out of time for this hour.
Right.
But one of the things that I'd like to have us talk about next hour is what can you do? It's one thing to say, okay, the science of economics says in a couple of years we're going to have a recession, which it generally is preceded by the market doing unpleasant things in a negative way. If you are at retirement and you're taking money out of a portfolio, or if you are approaching that point, then what can you do and what should you be doing to prepare for that? It's rather like living on the coast during hurricane season. It's probably a good idea to recognize that you're going to get one. And there's things you can do to prepare yourself for it if you live near the coast, other than just evacuate. And we'd like to, I think it's a good idea to talk about that, because I've never seen such a near unanimous agreement that everything we know about economics says we're headed for a brick wall pretty fast, and we're going to encounter it about 2020.
Now, having said that, we're out of time for this hour, because there's some really good productivity numbers that came out that I want to talk about on steel and aluminum manufacturing.
Cool. Yeah.
We're out of time for this hour. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we do give personalized investment advice to high net worth folks as fiduciaries. The phone number to call locally is
254-947-1111.
Or you can reach that number 1-800-914-7526. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email us directly at jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. We actually read those emails. They provide great fodder for us. Until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.